Phenomenal Meal Holding Gate. Thank you so much for being here. Let's continue with part whatever it is of the selection of the time. Should have looked that up earlier. All right, next question. In what way are these three schools in error? And we were just talking about the Flower Garland Lotus Sutra, the Mahavatarchana, nothing more than an arranger of worldly compromises. Let's see, we were talking about, I'm sure it's True Word Zen and the Nembutsu. So anyway, let's go on. In what way are these three schools in error? Answer, let us first consider the Pure Land School. So there we go. In China, in the time of the Qi Dynasty, there was a monk named Dan Huan. He was originally a follower of the Three Treatises School, but when he read the treatise by Nagarjuna, entitled Commentary on the Ten Stages Sutra, he espoused the two categories of the difficult to practice and the easy to practice way. Later, there was a man called the meditation master Tao Cho, who lived during the Tang Dynasty. Originally, he had given lectures on the Nirvana Sutra, but when he read Dan Luan's account of his conversion to resolve in the Pure Land teachings, Tao Cho abandoned the Nirvana Sutra and likewise changed over to the Pure Land resolve. Establishing the two categories of the Sacred Way teachings and the Pure Land teachings. In addition, Tao Cho had a disciple named Shan Tao, who posited two types of religious practice that he called sundry practices and correct practices. In Japan, some 200 years after the beginning of the latter day of the law, in the time of the retired emperor Gotoba, there lived a man named Honen, and Honen comes up a lot in these discussions, right? Addressing his words to all monks and lay believers, he stated, quote, Buddhist teachings are based upon the capacity of the people of the period. It's interesting, not entirely wrong, but listen to the way he says this. The Lotus and the Sutra and the Mahavatarchana Sutra, the doctrines of the eight or nine schools, including the Tendai and True Word, the teachings of the Buddha's lifetime, the Mahayana and Hinayana, the exoteric and esoteric, provisional and true teachings, as well as the schools based on them, were all intended for people of superior capacities and superior wisdom, who lived during the 2,000 years of the former and middle days of the law. Now that we've entered the late day or the latter day of the law, no matter how diligent one may practice such teachings, they will bring no benefit. I totally flipped everything. Why would he do that? Why would Honen do that? This was early in Japan's formation, prior to it being Japan the nation. It was a fiefdom of several lords, right? So Honen obviously was wanting to muscle himself in as a power broker, a political force. So he takes all of these teachings. He says, those were for the smart people from, you know, way back when. It's an interesting look on history, and it points to a cultural thought pattern that says the great elders of the past were much more wise, much more imbued people. And, you know, we're just the peasantry that's trying to pick up the pieces and learn from them. It's a distortion of a particular ilk, and you can see it rear itself in these kinds of overarching statements. I don't know, with the mindset, I'll say, of the West, I don't think that kind of thinking would fly very well here. At any rate, Blah, 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 blah. Moreover, if one mixes such practices with the practice of the Nembutsu addressed to Buddha Amida, then the Nembutsu will be rendered ineffective and will not lead the believer to rebirth in the Pure Land. So this is an interesting censorship now of the more the latter teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha. He's now taken the Lotus, Mahavajrayana, all the latter Mahayana teachings and relegated them to a place ineffectual to the current people of Japan, and declares that if they try to mix any of that, in other words, don't even try, with the teachings of chanting to this mythical Amida Buddha, that your practice won't amount to anything. You won't gain enlightenment. You won't get there. Amida Buddha will just say, eh, because you didn't listen. This is not, quote, this is not something that I have taken it upon myself to declare. Bodhisattva Nagarjuna and the Dharma teacher Dan Luan both designated such practices as the difficult to practice way. Dao Cho says that not a single person ever attained enlightenment through them, and Shan Dao affirms that not even one person in a thousand can be saved by them. These persons, whom I have quoted, were all leaders of the Pure Land School. And so you may be inclined to question their words. But there's a sage of former times, Eshin, unsurpassed by any wise monks of the Tendai or True Word School in the latter age. He stated in his work entitled The Essentials of Rebirth in the Pure Land that the doctrines of exoteric and esoteric Buddhism are not the kind of a teaching that can free us from the sufferings of birth and death. This is Honen talking again. Moreover, the work entitled The Ten Conditions for Rebirth in the Pure Land by Yokan of the Three Treatises School states the same opinion. Therefore, if people will abandon the Lotus Sutra, True Word, and other teachings, and devote themselves entirely to the Nembutsu, the 10 persons out of 10 and 100 persons out of 100 will be reborn in the Pure Land. These pronouncements of Honen precipitated debates and disputes with the monks of Mount Hiei, Toji, Onoji, and the seven major temples of Nara. But Eshin's words in the preface to his Essentials of Rebirth in the Pure Land appeared to be so compelling that in the end, Keshin, the chief monk of Mount Hiei, surrendered to the Nembutsu doctrine and became a disciple of Honen. Something was going on behind the scenes there. In addition to that, Nichiren continues, even people who were not disciples of Honen began to recite the Nembutsu to Amida Buddha far more often than they paid reverence to any other Buddha, their mouths continually murmuring it, their minds constantly occupied with it, until it seemed that everyone throughout the country of Japan had become a follower of Honen. In the past 50 years, every person within the four quarters of the nation had become a follower of Honen. And if everyone has become a follower of Honen, then every person in the country of Japan is a slanderer of the law. Now, if 1,000 sons or daughters should band together to murder one parent, then all 1,000 of them would be guilty of committing the five cardinal sins. And if one of them, as a result, should fall into the Avicii hell, then how could the others escape the same fate? In the end, and this is, again, we hear this tale constantly of association, guilt by association. You have to be careful who your friends are and who you follow, who your influences are, in other words. Because ultimately, an influence is an influence, but if you take on that influence into your own life, then it's no longer an influence, it's who you are. You have to take responsibility. Emulation or not, it is you who are now making the cause. This is constantly brought up throughout Buddhism, right? It's kind of, you could say it's almost the verso of Bodhisattva practice. That is, in our Bodhisattva practice, we are cause-awakened ones. So we make strong influence not only for ourselves, but our environment, which are actually the same. And so we put a Buddha way influence into our relationships with others, with ourselves, with our environs, all the same thing, right? So on the flip side, if you're a negative, evil, destructive, unlife-affirming influence, you might say self-destructive primarily, that influence of self is your environment, is others, whether you directly inculcate them into your negative influence or not. Again, they're responsible for their behavior, but you're responsible for your influence, your field, your force field of negativity, and it penetrates everything that you're in, right? So karmically, that's your immediate family first, and your ancestry, and then the people you're in contact with. So that same, what I'm saying is that same field that is your influence, whether it's positive or negative, is what this is all about. Because your field of influence firstly takes place in your self, in your existence, more accurately. Because moment to moment, what is your 3,000 realms resolving to in each moment to moment of this lifetime of successive moments. Understanding then that this is how your life is affected by your own influence, your own energetic, kinetic energy into this samsaric world. Then understanding that the environment is not a separate thing from you. That is an aspect of you. And then to extrapolate from that, that not only is your environment an extension of yourself, but so is all things in that environment, including other people, plants, places, things, so on and so forth. So to adjust your kinetic energy toward maximal potential of creativity, of life-affirming behavior affects the way your life condition is in life, and therefore your condition bringing about an environment that supports that greater life condition influences others around you and in your immediate center and moving out like a force field in an affirming way that would lead logically to the same goal of awakening and maximal expression of your potential in life. That is the Bodhisattva way. To not do that is to slip into either an idle, what we would say, the world of humanity, the world of Nin, the world of tranquility, which is in fact a backwards energy. We want to think of it as a flat, like nothing happens here, but the truth is, because we live moment to moment, when nothing happens, then that means nothing positive is happening. That actually is regressing, that itself is negative, all the way down to however evil you want to conceive of this. I'm saying it's just like a very linear equation, just like life is. So you constantly have this comparison hidden in the tales of Buddhism, is that your associations are affecting you in the same way you are affecting them. Ah, this works both ways. So you have to be cautious what you take into your affection. Follow? What you're attracted to, your affections, because they affect your kinetic motion through time, forward. So what causes, what spheres of influence are you accepting and molding into your forward motion? Buddhism is all about this mental sphere, this sphere of thinking, this consciousness, which is a constant assemblage of thinking, of thoughts, 3,000 realms in a single moment of thought. So let's go on. In the end, it would seem as though Honen, angry at having been condemned to exile, turned into a negative influence spirit and took possession of the sovereign and the monks of Mount Hiei and Onjoji, who had earlier persecuted him and his disciples, causing these persons to plot rebellion or to commit other negative influence acts. As a result, they were almost all destroyed by the Kamakura authorities in eastern Japan. The few monks of Mount Hiei, or Toji, who managed to survive, are treated with contempt by laymen and women. They are like performing monkeys that are laughed at by the crowd, or subjugated barbarians who are despised even by children. The men of the Zen school, now that he's taking the true word school apart, let's look at the history of the Zen school, taking advantage of this situation, pronounce themselves observers of the precepts, deceiving the eyes of the people and putting on such lofty airs that no matter what false doctrines they presumed in their madness to put forward, these doctrines were not recognized as erroneous. This school, called Zen, claims to represent a, quote, separate transmission outside the sutras. We're even superior to the Buddhist teachings. We're going to tell you what Buddhism really is about, because we're Zen masters. Which was not revealed by Shakyamuni Buddha in the numerous sutras preached during his lifetime, but was whispered in the secret to the venerable Mahakasyapa. Thus, the proponents of this school maintain that if one studies the various sutras without understanding the teachings of the Zen school, one will be like a dog trying to bite at a clap of thunder, or a monkey grasping at the moon's reflection in the water. Ugh, you poor ignorant people, you just don't get it. Zen is a false doctrine that appeals to the kind of people in Japan who have been abandoned by their fathers and mothers because of their lack of filial devotion, or dismissed from service by their lords because they are of their outrageous conduct, to young monks who are too lazy to apply themselves to their studies, and to the disreputable nature of courtesans. Even though its followers have all embraced the precepts, oddly enough, they are no more than swarming locusts feeding upon the people of the nation. That is why heaven glares down in anger and the gods of the earth shudder. So they're opportunists. They're opportunists who like the precepts because the precepts are full of asceticism, privations, tortures of the self. And they honor that as though that were what elevates them beyond all others, and also inculcates in their followers the need for submission to their grandeur, because they understand these tortures so well. It's an odd leap, but we still have that kind of thinking today, right? And Nichiren is saying these are the kind of people for whom this kind of teaching appeals. You know, how many religions on earth today have all kinds of rituals of self-immolation? I mean, not just the crucifixion, but there are other religions with all kinds of self-immolation behavior. in one way or another, condemning this lifetime itself as a punishment. Nothing could be further from Buddhism than this. Buddhism is not in any way to contort this life into some kind of a torture or a repayment or a sin or any of that. Buddhism is about living this life to its fullest. Buddhism, the Buddha way, Bodhisattva way, the Buddha enlightenment, the awakening to our highest form of intellect and knowledge, is within this samsaric experience. This lifetime is the most precious thing. So it's just diametrically opposed to any of those ideas of religion. So let's continue. The true word school is a far greater source of trouble than the other two schools I've discussed above. A major form of error, and I would therefore like to discuss it and outline it here. The reign of Emperor Huizong of the Tang Dynasty, the Tripitaka master Shan Wu Wei, Ching Chang Chi, and Pu Kung brought the Mahavarachana, diamond crowned, and Susidhikara sutras from India and introduced them to China. The teachings of these three sutras are very clearly set forth. If we look for the basic principle, we find that it consists of in unifying the two vehicles of voice hearers and cause awakened ones in the one vehicle of bodhisattvas and repudiating the two vehicles to reveal the one vehicle. As far as practices go, the school employs mudras and mantras. Mantras, plural, being some kind of a custom-designed bequeathing of words or characters or sounds to followers who are to repeat those mantras given to them, not from them. In other words, such a doctrine cannot compare even with the one vehicle of Buddhahood that is taught in contrast to the three vehicles of voice hearers, cause awakened ones, and bodhisattvas in the flower garland and wisdom sutras. Nor is it even as profound as the specific teaching of the perfect teaching that preceded the Lotus Sutra, as clarified by the Tendai school. In its basic meaning, at least, it corresponds merely to the two lower types of teachings, the Tripitaka teaching and the connecting teaching. The Tripitaka master, Shan Wu Wei, no doubt realized that. If he were to expound the teachings set forth in these sutras he brought from India, he would be ridiculed by the men of the flower garland and Dharma characteristic schools and laughed at by those of the Tendai school. And yet, since he had gone to all the trouble of bringing these works from India, probably he did not feel inclined simply to remain silent on the matter. At this time, there was a monk of the Tendai school called the meditation master Yi Xing, a perverse man. Shan Wu Wei went to him and questioned him on the Buddhist doctrines taught in China. Akarya Yi Xing, deceived as to his motives, not only revealed to Shan Wu Wei the main principles of the three treatises, Dharma characteristics and flower garland doctrines, but even explained the teachings of the Tendai school to him. Shan Wu Wei realized that the Tendai teachings were even finer than he had supposed when he had heard of them in India, and that the doctrines of the three sutras he had brought could never compete with them. But he set out to deceive Yi Xing, saying, quote, "My good monk, you are one of the cleverest men of China, and Tendai school has a truly profound and wonderful teaching, but the true word school, whose teachings I have brought to China, excels it in the fact that it employs mudras and mantras." Yi Xing appeared to find this reasonable, and the Tripitaka master Shan Wu Wei then said to him, quote, Just as the great teacher Tendai wrote commentaries on the Lotus Sutra, so I would like to compose a commentary on the Mahavacharana Sutra in order to propagate the true word teachings. Could you write it down for me? Yixing replied, that would be easy enough. But in what way should I write it? Yixing asked, saying, the Tendai school is unassailable, and though each of the other schools of Buddhism has competed in trying to refute its doctrines, none has gained the slightest success because of a single point. That point is the fact that in the Immeasurable Meaning Sutra, an introductory teaching to the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha declares that in the various sutras he has preached during the previous 40 and more years, he had not yet revealed the truth, thus invalidating the doctrines based upon those various sutras. And in the Teacher of the Law and the Supernatural Powers chapters of the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha states that no sutras that will be preached in latter times can ever equal the Lotus Sutra. In the passage of the Teacher of the Law chapter concerning the comparison of the Lotus Sutra and others preached at the same time, he also makes clear the superiority of the Lotus Sutra. To which of these three categories, the sutras preached before the Lotus Sutra, those preached contemporaneously with it, or those preached later, should the Mahavacharana Sutra be assigned? Very good question. At that point, the Tripitaka master, Shan Wu Wei, hit upon an exceedingly cunning idea. The Mahavacharana Sutra, he explained to Yixing, begins with a chapter called the Stage of the Mind, just as in the case of the Immeasurable Meaning Sutra, which refutes all the sutras that had been preached in the previous 40 and more years. The Stage of the Mind chapter invalidates all other sutras. The remaining chapters of the Mahavacharana Sutra, from the Entering the Mandala chapter through the end, became known in China in two versions, the Lotus Sutra and the Mahavacharana Sutra. Whoa. Though in India they continued constituted a single sutra. Shakyamuni Buddha, addressing Shariputra and Maitreya, preached the Mahavacharana Sutra, which he called the Lotus Sutra. But he omitted the explanations of the mudras and mantras and expounded only the doctrines. This is the work that the Tripitaka master Kumarajiva introduced to China and that the great teacher Tendai employed. At the same time, however, the Thus Come One Mahavacharana, addressing Vajrasattva, preached the Lotus Sutra, which he called the Mahavacharana Sutra. Oh, things are getting a little confusing here. This is the work now called the Mahavacharana Sutra, a work that I often saw when I was in India. Therefore, I want you to explain that the Mahavacharana Sutra and the Lotus Sutra are to be savored as works that are essentially the same in flavor, like water and milk. If you do so, then the Mahavacharana Sutra can stand superior to all the other sutras preached in the past, present, and future in the same way that the Lotus Sutra does. As to the mudras and mantras, if they are used to adorn the doctrine of the mind, which is expressed in the term a single moment of life comprising the 3,000 realms, this will constitute a secret teaching in which the three mysteries are provided. And with this doctrine containing the three mysteries, the true word will prove superior to the Tendai school, which speaks only of the mystery of the mind. The true word school is like a general of the first rank who dons armor, slings his bows and arrows over his shoulder, and fastens a sword at his waist. But the Tendai school, with nothing but the mystery of the mind, is like a general of the first rank who is stark naked. Acharya Yixing wrote all this down just as Shan Wu Wei dictated it. Throughout the 360 states of China, there was no one who knew about this ruse. At first, there were some disputes over the relative merits of the Tendai and True Word teachings, but Shan Wu Wei was the kind of person who was able to command a great deal of respect, whereas the men of the Tendai school were regarded lightly. Moreover, at this time, there were no men of wisdom such as the great teacher Tendai had been. Thus, day by day, the Tendai school lost more ground, and the True Word school, and finally, to the True Word school, and finally, all debate ceased. Not was won over, but just ceased. They just lost energy. As more and more years have gone by, these fraudulent beginnings of the True Word school have become completely obscured and forgotten. When the great teacher Dengyo of Japan went to China and returned with the teachings of the Tendai school, he also brought back the True Word teachings. The Tendai doctrine he recommended to the Emperor of Japan, but the True Word teachings he turned over to the eminent monks of the six schools to study. Dengyo had already established the superiority of the Tendai teachings over those of the six schools before he went to China. After he came back from China, he attempted to establish an ordination platform for conferring the precepts of perfect and immediate enlightenment, but this involved him in a great deal of controversy. He had many enemies and probably felt that establishing the ordination platform would be difficult enough to accomplish even if he devoted all his efforts to it. Or perhaps he felt that the refutation of the True Word teachings should be left until a latter day of the law. In any event, he did not discuss the True Word teachings in the presence of the emperor or make any clear pronouncement of the matter to his disciples. However, he did leave a one-volume secret work entitled A Clarification of the Schools Based on Tendai's Doctrine, in which he describes how various monks of the seven schools were won over to Tendai's teachings. In the preface to that work, he mentions the fraudulence of the True Word teachings. So it's not like he was unaware. He just didn't make a great deal of it because he had so much work to do to establish the correct platform. The great teacher Kobo went to Tang, China during the Enrakyu era. When the great teacher Dengyo went, there he studied the teachings of the True Word School under Hui Kyo of the temple called Qing Lung Si. After returning to Japan, he pronounced judgment on the relative merits of the doctrines preached by Shakyamuni in the course of his life, declaring that the True Word teachings ranked first, the Flower Garland second, and those of the Lotus Sutra third. The great teacher Kobo enjoys a quite unusual amount of respect among the people of our time. However, although I hesitate to touch on such matters, in questions of the Buddhist teachings, he committed a rather unusual number of errors. If we stop to consider the matter in general, it would appear that when he went to China, he merely learned the ritual mudras and mantras that are used by the True Word School, and introduced these to Japan. So he liked the ruse. Again, obviously another power grab, right? But he does not seem to have delved into the doctrines of the school to any great extent. He went to China at the same time as Dengyo or as Saicho. And so instead of being allies, it looks as though he set himself as a competitor, because one didn't travel to other countries unless it was a serious matter of intelligence in the modern way, learning and sourcing information, separating good information from chaff, and unearthing the matter, the truths evident. That would be shown by travel rather than word of mouth. After he returned to Japan and observed the situation at the time, he saw that the Tendai school was flourishing to an unusual degree. Dengyo was being successful. And he concluded that it would be difficult to propagate the True Word doctrines that he himself adhered to. So he was won over to this fallacious true word school, right? Therefore, he adopted the viewpoint of the Flower Garland school, whose doctrines he had studied earlier in Japan, declaring that the Flower Garland Sutra was superior to the Lotus Sutra. But he realized that if he simply asserted the superiority of the Flower Garland Sutra over the Lotus in the same manner as the Flower Garland school, people would not be likely to pay much heed to his words. He consequently gave a new twist to the Flower Garland doctrine, declaring that his argument represented the true intent of the Mahavacharana Sutra, mind aspiring for enlightenment by Bodhisattva Nagarjuna and Shanwu Wei, thus bolstering his position with absurd falsehoods. And yet the followers of the Tendai school failed to speak out strongly against him. They probably just dismissed him as just another loon, a power grabber. But in those days, if you didn't reassert clarity to people, they would be easily swayed, not least of which for fear of their own lives, because this was a feudal state, right? Question. In these treatises on the 10 stages of the mind, the precious key to the secret treasury and a comparison of exoteric and esoteric Buddhism, the great teacher Kobo makes such statements as, quote, each vehicle that is put forward is claimed to be the vehicle of Buddhahood, but when examined from a latter stage, they are all seen to be mere childish theory, end quote. Quote, Shakyamuni Buddha is in the region of darkness, not in the position of enlightenment. Wow. The various exoteric Mahayana sutras, such as the Lotus Sutra, are comparable to the fourth flavor, that of butter. And the Buddhist teachings of China vied with one another to steal the ghee, the fifth flavor, of the true word, and claim that it is the possession of their own school. What are we to make of such statements but put forth in these commentaries? Answer. I have been greatly astonished at the statements in these commentaries and have accordingly searched through the various sutras, including the three attributed to the Thus Come One Mahavacharana. But I do not find a single word or phrase in the sutras to indicate that in comparison to the Flower Garland and Mahavacharana sutras, the Lotus Sutra is mere childish theory, quote-unquote, that with regard to the Six Paramita Sutra, Tendai acted as a thief, or that the Protection Sutra describes Shakyamuni Buddha as beginning or being, quote, in the region of darkness, end quote. These are all utterly ridiculous assertions, and yet for the past 300 or 400 years, a sufficiently large number of intelligent persons in Japan accepted them, so that they now have come to be looked upon as perfectly reasonable and well-founded. I would like, for the moment, therefore, to discuss some of the more patently false opinions put forth by Kobo and point out other absurdities in his thinking. This is really going to put the matter to rest here. Now, how does this figure into the title of this Gosho, The Selection of the Time? Nichiren, if nothing else, he is a profoundly educated scholar. And so, as he establishes time periods and the reason for certain teachings taking hold and being appropriate to the time, he also has to account for those propaganda, those politics, those teachings that are being set upon and competing with the correct teachings. Because as if nothing else in Buddhism, we find that there's always this push-pull. There's always this, and this is samsara, isn't it? It's an expression of samsara. that what I was talking about earlier, that fear of influence, that sphere of influence that we manifest, that we nurture or cave into, that is our more positive, life-affirming strength and inertia, that is what manifested us in the first place. This is why there's this consistency from beginning to end, that life is precious because it is manifest of the greatest potential. And therefore, to live life with anything less than that same inertia is to defame it, slander it, to cast it away, to be unfilial. See, all these concepts, they're all from this basic understanding of this whole process of life itself, from pre-human to whatever human becomes, right? So, in other words, in order to demonstrate the selection of the time, it also is incumbent upon Nichiren to then show what these other competing doctrines and schools were trying to prohibit in that time. Is also validation, in other words, of the occurrence of a forward movement in the teachings of Buddhism, that it was in fact the appropriate time for these teachings, just because of the resistance they encountered in the form of these fallacious teachers. But if he's to be understood and believed in that theory, then he has to demonstrate, he has to prove it out. And this is why he uses the scholarship of the teachings themselves to demonstrate how ridiculous some of these assailers were, which also, vice versa, indemnifies his claim that the Lotus Sutra is the superior teaching, and that this particular time was meant for it to flourish in at whatever stage it was foretold as well, which is also in the sutras. So everything jives together, if I can use such a colloquial term. So let's continue. It was during the period of the Chen and Sui dynasties that the great teacher Tendai likened the Lotus Sutra to ghee, the finest flavor. It was some 200 years later, in the middle years of the Tang Dynasty, that the Tripitaka master Prajna translated the Six Paramita Sutra and introduced it to China. Only if the Six Paramita Sutra, which compares the Dharani teachings to Ghi, had existed in China during the Chen and Sui Dynasties, would it make any sense to claim that the great teacher Tendai stole the Ghi of the True Word teachings. You see that we're talking about hundreds of years, but history, especially to the common man, but you wouldn't think to these learned individuals, would be so easy a thing to manipulate and throw around. Things that happened 100 years after something else somehow precede the earlier teaching. What? So Nichiren, being the master educator and student that he is, can point these out and go, look, you know, the horse and buggy didn't come after the Ford Econoline van. They just didn't. They may still exist, but that doesn't mean they're superior. And you can't put one in place of the other. So this is the kind of argument he's making, right? A similar example exists, he goes on to say, in the case of the monk Tokuitsu of Japan. He bitterly criticized the great teacher Tendai for rejecting the doctrine of the teachings of the three periods that is set forth in the Profound Secret Sutra, declaring that Tendai had used his 3-inch tongue to destroy the Buddha's 5-foot body. The great teacher Dengyo, in turn, attacked Dokuitsu, pointing out that the Profound Secret Sutra was first introduced to China by Xuanzang in the early decades of the Tang Dynasty. In other words, it was brought to the country a number of years after Tendai Chiche, who lived during the Chen and Sui dynasties, had already passed away. How then could he have rejected a doctrine that was not introduced to China until the period after his passing? Faced with such an argument, not only was Dokuitsu reduced to silence, but his tongue broke into 8 pieces and he died. So, in other words, the history of Dokuitsu after that, he's pretty unknown. It just, his, whatever he had said just fell apart, right? His tongue is a metaphor for what he spewed, what he said to people. And after that encounter, basically everyone who had heard what he said just went, he's full of baloney. And so the lore of Dokuitsu, nobody heard any more from him until he passed away. But this is nothing compared to the negative influence accusations made by Kobo. In his writings, he labels as thieves Fa Tsang of the Flower Garland School, Chia Tsang of the Three Treatises, Xuanzang of the Dharma Characteristics, and Tendai, as well as other various Buddhist leaders of the northern and southern China, and in fact, all the Tripitaka masters and Buddhist teachers who have lived since the time when Buddhism was first introduced to China in the latter Han Dynasty. I mean, he went whole hog. In addition, it should be noted that likening the Lotus Sutra to ghee was by no means a comparison invented by Tendai on his own initiative. The Buddha himself said in the Nirvana Sutra that the Lotus Sutra is like ghee. And later, Bodhisattva Vasubandhu wrote that the Lotus Sutra and the Nirvana Sutra are comparable to ghee. And Bodhisattva Nagarjuna terms the Lotus Sutra a wonderful medicine. So if one who compares the Lotus Sutra to ghee is a thief, then are not Shakyamuni, many treasures, the Buddhas of the Ten Directions, Nagarjuna, and Vasubandhu thieves? All main characters in what Kobo was then claiming superiority with. I mean, he's decimating his own pedestal, as it were. All right, where are we time-wise? Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and pause here. We have so much to go through, but it's really wonderful once you start getting in the rhythm of how these arguments are put together, and more to the point, what they are clarifying as historical fact and in the construct and the teachings of Buddhism. As a modern student, when we, if we get interested in an older sutra, an early Mahayana sutra, or even a Hinayana, we can, with the lens of Nichiren scholarship, easily place where the attitudes are, not only in the teachings themselves, but as we're learning, through the proponents of different schools, how they manipulated certain teachings to go their way. It becomes kind of obvious. It's, I can think of no really good analogy right now, but it's to me, it's like when somebody tells you something that makes you wince a little bit, like, how do you know that? You may even want to say to that person, where does that come from? Well, sometimes you're not able to say that because you're not having a open dialogue with someone. You're maybe hearing it from somebody of a higher stature, right? An authoritarian regime that come, maybe you hear it from a teacher in a classroom, and it makes you wince. You go, how did you get that? And maybe you can't, or you don't feel comfortable questioning them, or you do question them, and they just rain down on you with a bunch of illogical stuff. And so you then hesitate to question them again, right? But in your own research, in reading outside the books they want you to read, or reading outside information that maybe ancillary connections, different subjects or something, it becomes very clear to you not only how that person was completely incorrect, but how they managed to construct something wholly illegitimate out of not necessarily misinterpretations of some influences from other places, but outright falsehoods, contradictions, to adopt their particular worldview. I don't know how many of you that's happened to. It's happened to me in my life several times, which is what made me more and more convinced that I can only be truly a student of my own scholarship. That the only way we can truly know or feel confident in something is to A, always question what we think we know, B, continually research. No matter what it is we're researching, there are certain points of view that will suddenly either fall away or come into questions that may not be in direct line with what we're studying, but they will be related. And those things will be adjusted, whether we're conscious of it or not. And then I find myself, as I teach myself this in my life, that this realization from my own observation in my own life agrees, fits incredibly well with what Shakyamuni taught in Buddhism. That ultimately, it's you and me working on ourselves who come through our own path, through our own realizations, to the final expression, or the ultimate expression, I should say. And in Buddhism, that is no less than awakening our complete potential, our total enlightenment, to that nature of all things, all this process of life, of which we are an essential part, but a part. A part indicating that we share this essential enlightenment. And from that comes the Bodhisattva way, that spreading of the influence of our inertia, as we all share in this inertia, moving, expanding universe. It's pretty amazing, really. What's even more amazing about it is that you can know this. You can experience this. Just as amazing, I might add, as to why others might not. How can you not? Yeah. I don't laugh because it's funny. I laugh because it's so glaring, right? Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Thank you so much for participating. We will continue with this very profound Gosho. I hope you're enjoying it. I certainly am. And I'm enjoying your participation in it. So again, many, 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 many thanks, gratitude. Proud. I'm so overwhelmed with not an egotistic pride, but a sense of profound appreciation for just doing this with you. All right, enough gushing. Namo myoho renge kyo. I'll see you in the next one, okay?